Well, my body could use a little swimming. I keep my shirt on when I go swimming. And I ain't seen my feet since 1984. The old lady wants to roll in the hay. We turn the lights down all the way. Cause I don't look good naked anymore. One hand, but I can't do the things I've done before. Well, it all happened kind of slow, but I guess I kind of let myself go. Now I don't look good naked anymore. Every passing year came a lot of french fries and beer, and my belly hung a little closer to the floor. Now my belly is as big as a truck, and the old lady don't wanna, she don't wanna, cause I don't look good naked anymore. No, I don't look good naked anymore. I'm a deep fried double wide version of a man.
Go. I don't look good when I'm naked anymore. That was Snake Oil Willie Band. That's, they got about 3,000 hits last week, or 3 million hits. So I think that song's going to take off. And they're going to follow it up with one about Christmas. But I heard an interview with them. They're not telling what's going to be in the song. So I guess we'll have to wait till on about November before we're going to start hearing their new song. So I like that. Hey, this is White Aryan Resistance, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana 46581. Our big White Aryan Resistance website is resist.com, and I kept giving you the wrong email for my webmaster, and it's merchandise resist at yahoo.com. So if you had trouble getting through to her, well, that's the one. Yeah, resist, merchandise resist at yahoo.com. Sometimes I even screw it up. And according to my latest information, Sling Blade and I are going to get together tomorrow sometime and do a show. I didn't think I was going to be able to do it because I got to do a couple other things, but we're going to do it. So, and also he said he's slipping me a fresh new show in the mail for our Saturday show for Sling Blade. So there we go. Well, it's Labor Day. I don't think there are too many people out there really getting too excited about it because the pay has dropped, or at least it's not going up since about 1965 or something. And the people of this state, they voted for, and I think it was fixed. I think I'm going to be a false flagger here, a right winger, and say they screwed with the machine, the voting machine, because that right to work cheap passed here. Of course, you know that. And they're selling off a lot of the state-owned property, like freeways and stuff like that. And so, and then no sooner did they get the right-to-work cheap law passed, and they told all the corporations, well, now you can come to Indiana and hire them for nothing. And all of a sudden now they've got the deal going with what's transversal or something, where the corporations have decided and figured out a scam where they'll put all their main offices in other countries. They may keep a factory here, but they're going to put their main offices in other countries so they don't have to pay their share of the taxes. You see, that's the way the ruling class act. You see, and if they say, oh, and then they're crying and crying, and a lot of working people swallow that shit, that the corporate taxes are just too high, we gotta lower those taxes, man. Well, actually, it's about the taxes they're paying now is about one third or less what they paid under the Eisenhower administration back in the 50s. So, did we live better back in the 50s than we do now? I think so. I like the 50s. So anyhow, when any of these people say, well, we got to take care of the ruling class and the corporates, get your head straight. Get your head screwed on straight. And then they march you off to occupying other countries to rob them of their goodies and oil or whatever, and you're dumb enough to volunteer to go and fight for my country. Fight for my country. You want to fight for your country, fight right here in your state, in your community, in your county, and like that. Like in Indiana, what I want them to do is go back and use the very constitutional immigration laws that they had even before the last century in the 1890s. And that was that you could bar the back then it was mostly the Asians, you can bar these aliens from your state. You didn't have to, it didn't have to be federal. And those laws were constitutional, and the Supreme Court never tried to overthrow them. So essentially any state can set up its own border patrol to keep illegal aliens out, and it's totally legal. So that's what you ought to advocate, because if you can't straighten out the whole country, at least you can work on your own state. How about that? Well, I guess Israel had some unintended circumstances and collateral damage from their pounding of the Palestinians, because they now have a tremendous drop in tourism, to the tune of, I think it was $300-400 million drop in tourism, where the Christian Zionists and so forth, they're not going over there and buying all that stuff, all those cheap souvenirs and stuff like that. So I guess it sort of backfired on them a little bit. What I'm trying to figure out now is where they're going to get all the cement and stuff to rebuild Gaza. And they'll probably bomb it out about every 6 months or a year anyhow. So I don't know about that. It's going to take a hell of a lot of cement. I thought I'd remind you people that I've still got quite a few war papers, from the old war papers. And I've got several tubs of them. And the reason I'm thinking about that is because I got a young man coming through today, and I'm going to load him up with a few hundred papers to go out and make the people happy in his community. If you want these papers, and I'll let you have them for 15 cents a piece, so you figure it out. And of course you're going to have to pay postage at that rate. Yeah, if you want to cause a little stir in your little hamlet, you get a few of those papers out. If you want to get something back on it, I don't know whether you do or whether you just want to raise hell, you'll have to get a stamp made and stamp your address or wherever you want to get credit, because obviously the addresses on the newspaper and phone numbers are not effective anymore. And I ain't in Fallbrook no more. I'd say you're probably better off just putting them out for shock value rather than trying to get returns off of, because we're not, if first thing that's going to come to your doors or come to your P.O. box is the cops want to join up, you know. So you're better off to just forget that. And if you're putting out leaflets and designing leaflets, I think you should just put them out for the shock value, waking people up if there's any left out there that could be woken up, instead of putting your P.O. box on it, because they're going to come after you. The news media does it, you know. They come right to your door to find out where you live, find out where you work, and either go to your door or your house and bring all the press in and show it on nightly TV, or they go to your workplace and you lose your job. So I don't think it's of any value anymore to put a personal identification or an address on the literature you put out. That's my opinion, and I think I'm correct. Well, my lady and I went out yesterday to a movie. We a lot of times try to take a movie in to sort of get away from the bunker here on Sunday. And we saw November Man with Brosnan. What's his first name? Keith Brosnan? Something. Anyhow, he played in a couple of, not The Man from U.N.C.L.E., that really dates me. He played in a couple of those 007 films, as I recall. I didn't really care for him. He looked a little bit too baby-faced and too handsome to be a real good agent. I think an agent should show some wear and tear and have a little craggy face and stuff like that. Like that new British guy that's doing it. He's not a pretty boy, but he fits what you would think a guy like that would be. But Brosnan now has gotten older, and his face has gotten a little craggier and like that, and he did a hell of a good job in this movie, as far as I'm concerned, on November Man. And one thing about the movie, it shows how untrustworthy your own system is, the way things change so fast in politics. And it shows how rotten CIA and all those people can be, and how they'll turn on you on a dime, as they did on Brosnan in this film. But he was one of the really super duper old time guys that knew all the angles, and he showed him you don't mess with Mr. Brosnan. Let me put it that way. So I think you'll like that movie. It'll probably be on cable TV before too long. Also was to his protege, who thought he was smarter than the old man, that when you got somebody to drop on somebody, you don't stand around and talk and argue about old times and all that. You got to drop on somebody, you shoot him. You just do it, man. You don't. The one thing that pisses me off in most of these movies is the hero and whoever the so-called bad guy will stand around and they'll argue and talk for 5 minutes before any shooting gets done, and that usually gives one of them a chance to pull some sneaky Pete and get away, you know. So he was teaching the kid right. Don't talk and don't get into conversations and all that. If it's going to be done, you just do it. Well, I watched a documentary on the Wabash Valley Prison, and I think it's federal, might be state, but anyhow, it was about an hour and a half, I believe, documentary. Now, that prison is not that far from me. I think it's about 40 miles from me. I think I've been by it because I've seen the gun towers and like that. It covered all aspects of the prison, and, you know, from the very, very hardcore, and they said there was quite a few white power in there, but a lot of those white power had been into methamphetamines and stuff like that, and then Aryan Brotherhood doing their thing. But and then they had their deal in there for psychiatric for people who were just plain nuts. You know, they don't put them in hospitals anymore. They put them in prison. And so That's a pretty sad situation for someone who needs psychiatric treatment. But putting a man in a 7 by 12 foot cell 23 hours a day would seem to me, and then not let him be in population out with the other inmates when they are out, would seem to me to be cruel and unusual punishment, and would tend to drive you more, make you more mean and more pissed off and the whole bit. That's my opinion. I think the prison authorities sort of shoot themselves in the foot. But they did have a lot of classes and things on all kinds of things that the prisoners could take, and that's what I keep encouraging these young white guys that happen to get into prison by, for some reason, take that time and educate yourself. You can get college courses. You can get a PhD in prison. So instead of sitting around feeling sorry for yourself, get right in there and become educated. So when you come out, you've got a trade. I mean, I'm working with guys who are wanting to become lawyers and all that kind of stuff, and trying to steer them in the right direction. And no more of that silly street stuff. Time to climb the ladder, baby, and get into the places where we really need you. I had a man in the office of a very well-known senator for several years until he didn't run anymore. But that's what helps. That's the way you find out things. And he reported to me every once in a while on something important. And that's what we need. You see, that's what the Jews and all the rest of these people do. They get in these offices and work for these senators and congressmen and so forth. And they get in there, and they even, some of them are writing the speeches and articles for these people, where the congressmen and senators are so busy out there trying to raise money for the next election, they've got a staff doing all the work. See, the Jews got onto that, and other people did too. And so the Jews got really close into all that stuff. And half the time you call a congressman or a senator, and you don't get to talk to him, you get to talk to staff, you're going to be talking to a Jew. Now, not necessarily that every Jew is a bad guy and like that, but I say I'd be a little careful and worried about that. You know, now the news is full of this stuff about gay black football players, and of course now they're all up in the air because of this one black football player that they made a big deal out of, and now the team cut him out, and now they're going to claim that's all kinds of racism. But the experts came back, and the people that are involved in football said, no, the guy just wasn't cutting the mustard. He couldn't cut the mustard in the NFL. He did pretty good in the college, but when he got to the NFL, that was a whole different breed of cat. But I don't know what they're putting in the food, because all these guys popping up homo, it's amazing. Just in the last couple of decades, how this thing has grown, there's got to be something behind it. And I don't know whether, like Sling Blade would say, it's in the water or in the food or it's in the air. I don't know, but man, it's not normal that the homosexual numbers would have grown that fast. And of course, then with the numbers, then they get into power and they get to even running for office and so forth like that. But anyhow, it's very interesting, and now we got these great big black football players, homosexual. However, I do know when I got out of the Army and stopped at, there's a place I used to go to up by the lakes where they had to dance, and I was sitting at the bar one time, and there was a guy sitting next to me, a couple of guys. They looked like halfbacks. I mean, they were big guys. Guys you would never suspect are homosexual. And a guy, I forget what he did, but he invited me over to their cabin to party, and there was something that one of them did that got me suspicious right off, and I forget what it was, but he gave himself a little bit of weight. So you know, you used to always think of homosexuals being effeminate and all that. Well, hell, they can be anything nowadays. But on the other hand, I'm not one of these guys like in the right wing and looking under every bed for a homosexual, because as long as they stay out of my way and as long as they don't get too much political power, which they are, unfortunately, then there's not much of a problem. You know, even Hitler, when they said about when all the rumors were going about this chief of the CIA, and can't remember his name right off. Boy, that's too bad. But anyhow, but he was, they didn't accuse him of being a homosexual. They accused him of being a pederast, which is he likes young boys, which is a little different than a standard homosexual who may be very straight as far as his association with people around him, where a pederast is out to get little boys, you know. And that was the rumor. But Hitler said, he says, when somebody said something to him about it, he says, it's not my job to go looking under every bed. So anyhow, at least for a while, that argument was squelched. Of course, that's a standard thing in the right wing, is accusing people of either being a federal agent, a snitch, part Jewish, or homosexual. And when somebody used to come at me about somebody being homosexual, I said, well, I don't know. He never tried to play with my pee-pee. How do you know someone's homosexual if you've never seen him in action? I mean, you know, I went to school with a kid here in Warsaw that I think his name was Danielson. He acted very effeminate, but there was never any proof or evidence that he had homosexual relations with anybody. So you got to watch that stuff. Well, I got my new sign up out front, my big 4x8 lighted sign. The message on it for this week is war and religion are rackets. So we'll see how many people go by and throw stones at my sign. So far, nobody's tried to put a stone through them. We got a lot of Bible beaters go by here, and some of them probably could get pretty nasty. You know, I heard this from a black gal on talk radio yesterday. She said, equal rights does not mean equal results. In other words, there is no equality. Equal rights, in other words, if you have all the privileges that the ruling class have decided to give you, but it still doesn't make you equal. So I thought that was pretty good on her part, because she's trying to straighten out her own race. Well, I've told you before that the only way the Negro, the African-American, is ever going to improve his lot is by gene hijacking or by just plain thievery and so forth, but by gene hijacking. And that's what they've set out to do, like I keep talking about, this mulatto Frankenstein race that they're creating, especially with the women. But plenty of white women lust after these mulatto guys too, like I'm trying to think of some big stars. Well, you know what I mean. So it's a two-way street, but the mulatto and of course a lot of these coffee-colored Mexicans and Cubans and all that, they climb up that way too. I said a long time ago, when Obama was just beginning to run for president, I said he's a fall guy, and there's nothing proves it to me more than what's going on with the Republican Party. Now, the ruling class will use racism for their own benefit, to protect their class. They're not total racist. They're not full, well-rounded racist at all. But they will use race to maintain their power, and the blacks are correct about that. Now, I've noticed that that Obama, a lot of times he does something that people should say, well, that was okay. He seems to be skirting putting boots on the ground anymore, which is technically, if he's honest about it, that's the thing to do. But you see how the Republicans crawl all over him in the media? That when he said he didn't have a strategy, well, most time presidents don't have a real strategy. They'll tell you they do, but they don't. So he says that, and they climb all over him. And we got to go to war, man. Come on, Sambo. We got to go to war. What do you think we put you in there for, you to be a puppet? So here's a black that was raised as pretty much like a white. And they've thrown all his stuff about his birth certificate and his school records and all that kind of stuff, which some of it may be true, some not. But that's just the way these cowardly Republican types, cowardly conservatives, attack him as a black guy. They hate his guts. However, if he would have served their total interests as a Republican, they'd probably set him up as quite a hero of the Republic. But he definitely is a fall guy, and he's looking like he's aged about 30 years since he's been in office. Have you noticed that? His hair is turning white. He's getting all these lines in his face and the whole bit. But I told you, he's a fall guy, and the Republicans are going to play him for every way but crooked the way they can, and then hopefully use that to get back in the White House. So anyhow, I don't care what people say. That Obama wants to do something to protect the food. Well, there's some things that can't be wrong. It can't be wrong to try to protect the food supply. I bought a bag of apples the other day at the grocery store, and I ate an apple, and all of a sudden I'm getting this terribly bitter taste on my lips, and I finally figured out it was apples. Those goddamn apples had insecticide on them of some type. Luckily, I only got a little bit on my in my mouth. But you've got to have standards for that kind of stuff. And so, and the school, I hear I hear a lot of these Republican types out there saying, oh, it's terrible. He's taking all the sugar machines out of school. The government's replaced them with, fruit and vegetables and so forth, and they don't like that, so they better have the sugar machines back in there. Well, how do they learn to eat badly like that? They're learning it at home and ads on TV. Of course they don't like to eat healthy food, because all they've been eating is unhealthy food, and their parents even keep giving them unhealthy food. So that when somebody steps in and say, you're physically a piece of shit, we're going to make sure you get the right kind of food to eat, a big variety, but still food, and raw food and so forth like that. He says, oh, I won't eat that. Obama's a communist. And all these Republicans, I hear them on the radio putting him down for that. And that is really, really bad. I mean, you can't, if you got an enemy or somebody you don't like, you can't say everything they do is bad, because it makes you look stupid, unless you're just trying to convince stupid people, which is pretty much the case. No matter what the Republican National Committee says, well, that's it, Did you ever notice these talk shows, how guys will get on there, whichever way it is, left or right, and they'll tell the moderator, oh, how much I love, you're wonderful, you're absolutely, oh, you're right on everything, and like that. It seems like there's a certain segment of society out there that worship these talk show guys. And if the talk show guy is conservative, conservative, right wing, he's got his followers that just literally, oh, thank you for letting me on the air. Oh, you're so wonderful. And you hear it on the progressive left, too. Do you ever notice that? I never, when I would call in a radio show, which I haven't done for a long time, I wouldn't say, oh, thank you for putting me on, He should be thanking me for wanting to talk to him. Well, they've got a Jewish outreach outfit now. I've got a little bit of a recording on it. It's not very good, but anyhow, that there's a certain segment of the Jews that are trying, they're going to reach out and recruit more people. I guess it's sort of like the vampire situation, that you can't just be using the same people to get your blood all the time. You need some new blood. So they're trying to, supposedly opening up the doors to Judaism a little bit to get some fresh blood in there.
Charge member who is not Jewish. So just the numbers alone tell us that we have to open up our doors. The other thing is that I'm not suggesting that we dilute Judaism as we lower our barriers, but many of the reasons why people find it difficult to enter into our institutions are that we hide behind religious law in order to keep them out. And most of the time, it's about, if you will, the corporate culture of our institutions, whether it be a secular institution such as the Jewish Federation or a Jewish Community Center, or a religious institution such as a synagogue.
So tell me some of the things that you're doing at JOI, the Jewish Outreach Institute. Well, I've participated in what's called the Grandparent Circle, but how did this philosophy become instantiated in programming opportunities?
Well, we program in two different ways. One is what we would call casting the widest net through our model of public space Judaism, and that literally takes Judaism outside of Jewish communal institutions into places where the Jewish community historically doesn't program, and yet that's where people spend their time. It seems to us that it's counterintuitive that the Jewish community would spend its time programming behind its four walls, and yet people don't participate. We've kind of upended the myth of Kevin Costner, who said, if you build it, they will come. We're arguing if you build it, they still won't come, and so we have to go out to where they are. That by casting the widest net, we're going to reach the largest number of people. We also have our more inclusive Judaism programs, which identify specific people in the community, such as one of our signature programs is for called the Mother Circle. It's for non-Jewish women raising Jewish children in the context of an interfaith marriage. We estimate there are about 250,000 women like that in the United States. And yet, when we started doing this work some years ago, they were considered pariahs in the Jewish community. Even Jewish feminists weren't interested in these women. We've not only moved them out of that pariah status, but in many cases, they've become unsung heroes in the Jewish community, because not only are they caring for the Jewish future, but in many cases, because women make decisions about elderly parents and their care, irrespective of whether they are daughters or daughters-in-law, they are also protecting the Jewish past.
Thank you. And all of that is available and so much more on JOI.org. Rabbi Lipsky, there is a posture of who is and who isn't allowed at the Shabbat table or at the Passover Seder, that a child goes to college, falls in love with a non-Jew, and the parent tightens up, says they won't cross the lintel into my household. And I'm a rabbi, you're a rabbi, we deal with this question on a pastoral level all the time. Do you have any counsel for anyone listening in this moment? What is the parent's response that you would recommend when someone calls and says, comes home from college and says, Mom, Dad, I've fallen in.
So, move over, four square. Move over, Jehovah's Witnesses. There's going to be a new boy on the block in his Black Crow outfit, maybe standing on your doorstep, inviting you into the brotherhood. I want to run a little piece of a radio show out of Israel that I recorded. It had to do with the question of why Jews weren't farmers, why they weren't into farming, and why they went into banking and so forth. Now, this is going to be sort of a soft approach to the answer to this, but this Italian gal has written a book about it, and there may be some things in here you might find interesting, or maybe not, but I'm going to run it and see what you think.
Ask you, why do you think there are so many Jews in the medieval period who are bankers, You mentioned restrictions. Talk about that a little bit. What were some of the theories that people have used to understand why Jews were not in agricultural work but in professional work?
Absolutely. I think that the most well-known and common explanation goes as follows. The Jews were not farmers, certainly not in the Middle Ages in Europe, because they could not own land, and hence, if you cannot own land, you cannot be a farmer. Second, the Catholic Church had bans on Christians lending money at interest, and hence this job was left basically to the Jews. And third, the crafts and trade guilds in medieval Europe excluded non-guilds members from engaging in crafts, trade, and so on. So the only profession that was left for the Jews was banking. Now, we knew as well these stories, these theories, I should say, when we started our project. But then we started to be skeptical and doubtful, and we tried to see and assess and look more carefully whether this explanation based on restrictions actually held true. And digging through the vast amount of literature that I mentioned at the beginning we read, we actually saw that these restrictions didn't exist. Meaning, restrictions came later, but they cannot be the explanation for the initial specialization of the Jews in craft trade and banking. So, but of course, if you are a serious scholar, it's not enough to criticize someone else's explanation. You try to provide your own explanation.
Before we get to your explanation, I just want to go back for a moment. I wasn't clear on the theory that pertained to the Catholic Church. Can you explain that a little bit better?
Yes, because during the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church became concerned that lending at interest was impoverishing people, and hence the Catholic doctrine prohibited Christians from lending money at interest. So according to some historians, if Christians cannot lend money at interest, someone else has to do it, and the someone else was the Jews. The problem with this explanation is twofold. Number one, despite the Catholic ban on lending money at interest, many Christians still lent at interest because, you know, one matter is to prohibit something by law, the other is what the reality, what practically people do. And we have a lot of evidence from historical sources that Christians still lent money at interest despite the church ban. But assuming for a moment that this ban actually was very strictly enforced, the problem with the explanation regarding the specialization of the Jews in banking because of this ban of the Catholic Church is totally wrong for the timing. Let me explain. We see from the historical sources that the Jews in medieval Europe, mainly in France, in Germany, and also England, were already practicing money lending very successfully and banking well before the Catholic Church makes lending at interest by Christian prohibited, which happened roughly in the 12th-13th century. Okay, the Jews were already specialized in money lending in these countries at least a century earlier, which means what? That the ban cannot be the explanation for the specialization of the Jews and their prominence in banking.
And the other explanation that's been very well accepted, that there was that it was illegal for Jews to own land, that you also disproved, those restrictions on Jewish land owning.
Absolutely. No, you're totally right, Sarah. And this one, we actually disagree even more strongly, and for the following reason. In the 15th century that our book studies, namely from the 1st century to the 1492 basically, we cannot find evidence of laws prohibiting Jews from owning land. And this is even more striking, not only in medieval Europe, because the Jews could own land and did own land. Simply, they didn't work the land. They didn't want to be farmers, but they could own land in principle. But this fact is even more striking in the Muslim period, in the Muslim Empire, a few centuries earlier, when the transition from farming into craft trade and banking actually occurred. Between the 8th and the 12th century, that's the crucial period when the Jews abandon agriculture and enter in huge numbers in crafts, trade, and banking. This is exactly the time when the Jews, if they wanted, they owned land. So that's why we are saying this explanation based on prohibition on owning land is completely, totally wrong, because there were no restrictions, no prohibitions on Jews owning land, especially at the time, 8th to 10th century, in the Muslim Empire, where almost 80% of the Jews were living at that time. So that's why we are saying we understand that is a popular explanation. The problem is, once you start digging carefully, once you start reading carefully the works of wonderful historians who devoted their entire lives reading primary sources and documents, this explanation based on land ownership prohibition for the Jews doesn't hold at all.
So then, Maricela, what is the theory that you and Tzvi Eckstein came up with? What explains the transition of Jews from farmers to moneylenders?
Yes, okay. So let me say first one very quickly an important thing. 2,000 years ago, the Jews are identical in terms of occupational structure to anybody else, okay? So 2,000 years ago, when our book starts, the Jews are exactly mostly farmers like everybody else. That's important to say, okay? Then something happened, and as I was saying before, between the 8th and the 10th century, in the Muslim Empire, where most of the Jews were living at the time, especially Mesopotamia, they leave agriculture and they enter in huge numbers in this urban, high-skill, high-income occupation. So why? Let's take a detour for a second and forget about economics for a moment, and let's move to religion. So 2,000 years ago, everybody, this is well known, that's not our personal discovery in this book, is well known by anybody who knows Judaism. Judaism underwent a profound, deep transformation in the following sense. Until 70, that is until the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, Judaism had two pillars. The Second Temple in Jerusalem, where sacrifices were made, and then the Torah, that every Jewish male individual was supposed to read. The destruction of the Temple destroys one of the two pillars, namely the Temple, permanently. Now, Judaism, from then on, becomes identified with reading, and more important, studying the Torah. The reading and the study was not required only for adults, but even more revolutionary for the period and more surprising, for kids, children, sons, more precisely. Okay, so we have a religious order that says that Jewish fathers should send their sons, their male children, from the age of 6 or 7 to the school or the synagogue to read and to learn the Torah. Now again, someone can say what this has to do with becoming merchants, bankers, doctors centuries later. Think about for a second. 2,000 years ago, everybody, including the Jews, were illiterate. You don't earn more if you are literate. So the decision by the religious leaders to ask their people to become literate, to read the Torah, to study the Torah, from an economic point of view, made no sense. It was a sacrifice. These are poor farmers who have to send a kid to school or the synagogue to learn and to study in a world that doesn't reward being literate or educated. However, why this was a complete sort of genius idea? Why? Once you learn to read the Torah, you can read basically any other book, any other letter, any other contract written in the same language, namely Hebrew or Aramaic, and then it's easier to learn other languages. So we have that the Jews, is not that they acquired only what we call religious literacy, that is the ability to read a religious text, but automatically they became literate to cool, because now you can read any other book, any other letter, as I was mentioning before. So, in a world where almost everybody was illiterate, the Jews, suddenly, they are literate, which for that time was a huge comparative advantage. However, as I said, 2,000 years ago, the world is mainly agrarian. yeah, you are a literate farmer, doesn't bring you much money. But what happens a few centuries later? Muhammad establishes Islam.
Well, you see here, now the Christian church did just the opposite. It fomented ignorance, even chaining the Bible to the altar so that the people couldn't even read the Bible, which the Jews used that to their advantage as far as reading the Torah and becoming able to speak and study and so forth. So here's another case where Christian Zionism type religion worked horribly against the white race, especially during the Middle Ages. So some of this stuff is good to understand, because you're going to find out that I think we're going to find out, and I have found out, like we've always said, our greatest enemy is among us ourselves, and the religion we've adopted and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, that's to me very important.
His successor built one of the largest empire in history, the Muslim Empire, stretching from Spain almost to India, with one language, one set of law, cities built from scratch, huge urban centers, commerce incredibly growing, and now comes the connection with everything that I said before. The Jews were the only one, basically, with this huge advantage in literacy, and were the first to abandon agriculture and farming and move into the cities that the Muslim rulers have built and start engaging in crafts first, then in trade, banking, medicine, all the kind of most skilled urban occupation you can think of. So the reason, to sum up, is they had a comparative advantage in education and literacy thanks to this change in their religion a few centuries earlier that nobody basically had at that time.
Now, the title of the book is The Chosen Few, and one of the factors that you confront in your book is that at the same time that this was happening, the Jews were becoming more literate and moving to urban areas, they also experienced a tremendous drop in their numbers. I mean, the population fell.
Absolutely.
Why?
Yes, exactly. In fact, the title, The Chosen Few, has exactly two words, okay? Chosen refers exactly to the fact that they become literate, educated, and then specialized in this urban occupation. The second word, few, refers exactly to the demographic trends that characterize Jewish history in these 15 centuries. The most dramatic decline happens exactly between the 1st and the 6th centuries, where the Jewish population mainly concentrated in Eretz Israel, Mesopotamia, Egypt, Syria, Turkey, and Southern Europe. These were the main locations in the first century. So Jewish population amounted to roughly, let's say, 5 million Jews. 6 centuries later, they were at most 1.5 million. So what happened? We know that there were wars and massacres, wars between the Jews and the Roman Empire. There were epidemics, huge epidemics, like the Justinian Plague in the 6th century. There were other natural causes that determine a drop in the total population, and of course also in the Jewish population. But the problem is, these factors cannot explain the whole decline from 5.5 million roughly to 1.5 million. So the other factor that contributed to this decline was conversions. Mm-hmm. Conversions out of Judaism into other religions, mainly Christianity. Let me explain how this happened. Christianity emerged as one of the religious groups within Judaism, and if you think about the core tenets of Christianity are very similar to the one in Judaism, but Christianity kind of took out some requirements that Jews were supposed to perform in order to be considered part of the Jewish group, including the requirement to send the kids to school by the age of 6 or 7 to learn the Torah. And think about again, 2,000 years ago, the world is rural. Here you have a religion that forces you to invest in your kids' education, which is costly, is expensive, is a burden, with few returns. And then there is another religion, very similar to the first one, which doesn't impose you this. It's not kind of hard to understand that probably a percentage of Jews preferred to change religion from Judaism into Christianity because they probably felt that more or less it was basically the same religion, but with fewer requirements, including the very expensive one related to educating the children. So part of the decline of the Jewish population between the 1st and the 6th century was due to conversions, voluntary conversions, not forced conversions. And let me emphasize, we are not claiming nowhere in the book that the entire decline was due to conversions, because everybody knows there were wars at these times, there were massacres, there were epidemics, so all these factors contributed to the decline of the Jewish population. What we claim in the book is that still there is a percentage that cannot be explained by this factor, and the only other explanation is conversions.
So that's great.
So that's quite interesting that the Jews that really got a leg up were living under the Muslim Empire. And to where there were giant big cities and all that, and they moved into the cities and got into commerce and education, all that kind of stuff, and they got a real leg up under the Muslims. Now, isn't that interesting? And now everybody's out there wanting to kill each other, but they got their biggest leg up by getting along in the Muslim areas. And of course, this deal where she's saying that a big percentage of Jews converted to Christianity because it was easier, and they didn't have to become send their kids to get them educated under the Torah and all that kind of stuff, which is really a step down in a sense, because they probably, under the Christian thing, see, the Christian hierarchy for sure seem to revel in keeping people stupid. But as you can see, Christianity of course came out of Judaism, and it was very similar in a lot of ways, but it was a lot easier for Jews to do that. So there was a big infiltration of Jews that converted into Christianity.
Jews as the chosen few, that is to say, a small Jewish urban professional class?
So it depends what you mean by discrimination, okay? Let me give you an example. Taxation, okay? Suppose that in some periods, in some locations, Jews or other religious ethnic minorities were, in quote, discriminated because, for example, they had to pay higher taxes. This actually happened. I give you an easy example. In the Muslim Empire that I mentioned before, Jews, exactly like Christians and other religious minorities, were called dhimmis. They were protected minorities, which meant the Muslim leaders let them practice their religion as long as the Jews and other religious minorities paid a poll tax. This was a tax levied on each head of the family. Okay, so is this discrimination? Yes, of course it is. The point is, this tax was raised on all religious minorities, not just on the Jews. So yes, it was discrimination, but it was not discrimination targeted especially against the Jews. So it cannot be an explanation from their transition from farmers into merchants, okay? Discrimination can come in other ways. For example, you can ask members of religious or ethnic minorities to wear special kind of clothes to live in a special part of a city. This certainly happened, we know very well, for example, in medieval Europe. But the point is, what has this to do with an occupational transformation that occurred centuries earlier? So all I'm saying is that it's true that in medieval Europe, Jews experienced episodes of discrimination, but the problem is the Jews in Europe were already specialized in crafts, trade, banking, well before this discrimination. So the discriminations cannot be an explanation for their occupational explanation. The Jews in medieval Europe came in two ways, either from the Byzantine Empire, through Italy basically, or from Northern Africa. When they arrived, they were not farmers, and then suddenly the next day they become traders or bankers because of discrimination. They come to medieval Europe already as successful merchants and traders, already as successful doctors, bankers, and so on. And so that's why we are saying the discrimination or prohibition story cannot explain their occupational structure, because they were already specialized in these occupations.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand you and Professor Eckstein are at work on a sequel to this book called The Chosen Many. And
yes,
you're looking in that book at the socioeconomic status of the Jews from the period of the expulsion in Spain to the present. What specifically are you trying to answer in that book?
Wow, that's a big question. Actually, Zvi is coming tomorrow here in Milan, and we have started reading in the past months, again, a huge amount of books and literature that has been written on Jewish history after 1500. There are several questions we try to answer. I throw a couple of them, okay, because there are so many that, you know, we cannot say all of them in the interview. So one interesting question is the following. Take a picture of the Jews in 1492, when our first book stops, ends, where there were basically roughly 1 million Jews in the world, okay? 500,000 Sephardim and 500,000 Ashkenazim. Okay, these are kind of very broad distinction, but just to give a kind of simple picture. Then, 4.5 centuries later, so at the beginning of the 20th century, the Jews in the world are now 16 million, 16.5 to be precise. 2 million are Sephardim, and 14 million are Ashkenazim. So the first puzzle is to explain how come that in 1492 there are almost roughly the same number of Sephardim and Ashkenazim, and 4.5 centuries later the Ashkenazim, in demographic terms, have grown so much more. Especially because, as everybody knows, this growth happened mainly in Eastern Europe, and sometimes in some places and periods where exactly the economic conditions were not exactly great, okay, or the political situation was not exactly peaceful, and yet we have this spectacular demographic growth. So that's one big puzzle to answer. Another interesting puzzle. We know that there was a large migration of Jews to the United States. We also know that many of them came very poor from the shtetl, and then in a matter of one generation, at most two, we again see them very successful in business. So the question is why? Why you come poor like many other immigrants, but then in a matter of one, two generations, again, you live in cities, you are engaged in these high-skill, high-income jobs. And the third puzzle is among the many that characterize the 500 years that we are now planning to study is during the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century, the Jews were not the major inventors, okay? So if one look at the Industrial Revolution, the great inventors and so on, we don't see many Jews, actually. In the subsequent stages of technological change and scientific progress, the Jews actually became among the major inventors, intellectuals, scientists, and so on. So how come? I hope that these three we call them puzzles, more humbly we can call them questions, are some of the many that we plan to address in our second journey of learning.
It sounds fascinating. I look forward to it.
Well, that was interesting. I think, you know, obviously you got to read between the lines, but you see that great growth in Jews, Ashkenazi, 60 million, they grew to 60 million. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't think any of these Jews had connection to the original Jews. I think the Sephardim were probably more truly linked to the Israel people than these Ashkenazim, which sounds to me like a hell of a lot of them were. It was an move for opportunity rather than anything else. And these are the people that really run Israel. Those Ashkenazi, which were Eastern European primarily, Russian, Polish, all that kind of people. So anyhow, the question is, you know, where did the real Jews go? And they say the lost tribes. Well, we'll leave that to some of these right-wingers, even like I used to be. We're the real Jews. Well, I don't believe that. So anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow, I think, with Sling Blade. And so 14-5 and shut up. And if you have comment on this radio show and this interview with this Italian lady, let me know. What do you think?
Night and you closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep, or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall, and the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it.